Should I begin? Can you hear me? Yes. Good morning, everyone. It is great to see you on this cold Saturday morning. I am Juliette Kayyem, and I'm going to be moderating a great hour ahead on a discussion on new threats in a modern age with three amazing authors who have contributed to a dialogue that maybe we've been having since the beginning of mankind. So here's how today is going to start. Jessica, I'm going to introduce the three authors and then let them speak a few minutes on their book, give them the opportunity to tell you what their book is about, and then I'll do a moderated discussion so we can pull out some major themes, and then we'll open it up to question and answer. As you know, their books will be on sale at the end of this, and they will be available for signature and discussion. So I want to start with my good friend, Dr. Jessica Stern. Jessica has spent a career in counterterrorism and thinking about the threats that this nation and this world faces with government positions and academic ones. She is now a lecturer at Harvard University and a fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health, one of Time Magazine's series of innovator winners. She is the author most recently of ISIS, The State of Terror, and that's a book she'll be talking about today. Bruce Schneier is a security technologist and CTO of Resilient Systems. His latest New York Times bestseller is Data and Goliath, The Hidden Battles to Collect Your Data and Control Your World. He is also a fellow here at the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School, which many of you probably know about that center and its work in technology and innovation. And then Gabby Bloom, or Gabriella Bloom, is the Rita Hauser Professor of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law at Harvard Law School, where she focuses on international law, negotiations, and the law of armed conflict. She's also the faculty director of the Program on International Law. Gabby's new book, of which, why isn't it here, with the exact title, which I know because I read it, I want to get it right, The Future of Violence, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones, is a recent contribution by her to this notion of asymmetric threats, right? These new things that are coming that aren't exactly armies, but they are as risky sometimes as foreign armies. So I want to start with Jessica, Dr. Stern. If you could tell us a little bit about your book and research and something we talk a lot about today, ISIS.
Sure. Thank you so much. I think I'll just tell you what I think is new about this organization. First of all, as you know, it holds territory. It is very good at capital, labor, and brand. It raises money through oil sales. Their oil production is much more resilient than anybody anticipated. They also tax refugee flows. This is a perpetual resource for them. They create refugees and then they tax the refugee flows. They're very good at attracting both locals, taking advantage of the disenfranchisement of Sunni Arabs, but also unprecedentedly good at attracting foreign fighters. About 30,000 foreign volunteers coming in, not just fighters, but also they're seeking doctors, engineers, people like Bruce. I hope they haven't recruited you yet. they really are capitalizing on a frustration with modernity very well. We see converts flowing in, people who are looking for a purer, simpler life. I'll stop there. I think that's 2 minutes.
Okay, Jessica. Thank you very much. Bruce, I wanted to turn to you about your new book and the threats that you examined.
So my book is called Data and Goliath, which I think is a really cool title.
Yes.
And I was thrilled.
You win.
Except for people who pronounce it Data and Goliath and just don't get the joke. And the book is fundamentally about data, about our data, about the data that is produced by the computers we interact with, our phones, our computers, ATM machines, all the computers in our life. And it's about what happens to that data, who uses it, which makes the book fundamentally about surveillance. Because this data is about us, right? All of our phones know we are in this room, and there are companies that know that data and know we're in this room. I talk about corporate surveillance, which is really how a lot of the data is generated. I talk about government surveillance, both good governments and bad governments, who use that data for their purposes, which means the book is really about control. It's about persuasion on the advertising side. It's about social control and law enforcement on the government side. I talk about why this is important, you know, why in society today we need to think about our privacy with respect to data. And really, I'm trying to talk about what I think is a fundamental issue of the information age, which is how do we extract data value to the group while preserving individual privacy. So for example, I used Waze to get here this morning. That's why I am on time. When Waze works, because everybody who uses Waze is under surveillance, and it can tell me traffic patterns because of that. So an enormous group benefit, yet everyone using it is under surveillance. How do we as society balance this? Whether it's law enforcement or medical or traffic or any other application. And I'm trying to explore those issues in the book.
Gabby.
So you walk into your shower and find a spider. And that spider can be real and odds are it's harmless. Or this spider can be a mini surveillance drone sent by your next door neighbor who dislikes your noisy dog. And she's relaying pictures of you naked from a local sports bar on her iPhone on the TV screens to the mirth of the neighborhood. Or it could be more menacing possibilities that it's a lethal spider drone sent by your business competitor who purchased it from a bankrupt military contractor. He's now vacationing in Provence, but he uses a computer chip on that little mini drone to order to direct the drone to shoot an infinitesimal needle into your left thigh. And then orders the drone back through a crack in the bathroom window and orders it to self-destruct. Neither the spider nor its operator are ever found. So if you think this is sci-fi, you and I can now both purchase online from private vendors a AA battery-sized drone already that comes with surveillance, with camera, and making it lethal is just the next step. So this is a little taste of what drones and robotics more generally are opening up as opportunities for harm. We all know about cyber, and Bruce is really the expert on that. Biotechnology is two steps ahead of us, but we can now, again, you and I, purchase genetic sequences online in lab equipment, and what used to be very complicated science that only the most expert professors could do is becoming routine for the graduate student among us. What is common to all these technologies is that they're becoming more accessible, cheaper, easy to handle, and they distribute power. And they allow not just direct attacks, but remote attacks as well. So together, in combination, they create what we call in the book a world of many-to-many threats, where every individual, group, corporation, or state now poses a threat to any other individual, group, corporation, or state anywhere around the world. And the question for us in the book is, how do we govern a world of many-to-many threats? How do we govern it on the domestic level? And how do we govern it on the international level?
Okay, great. That was a wonderful summary. And so I'm going to ask some questions that draw out themes in all the books, which I read, and all of them are tremendous, and then hope for a dialogue amongst the authors. At the end, I do want to get into the government, sort of what can we do, what can people sitting here do. But I want to talk about this notion of asymmetric threat. So, you know, your book, Bruce, you know, David and Goliath, we've had a notion of asymmetric threats. You think about the Revolutionary War, rebellions, you know, freedom fighters, whatever you want to call them, that nations have always faced asymmetric threats that are challenges. In what ways is the modern age different, but in what ways is it similar to challenges that we faced in the past, given that it seems like technology is going faster than anyone can respond to at any given time?
I think this is a theme common in all three books, and it's a notion of a democratization of tactics and weaponry. Right? If we walked outside and saw a tank, we would know a military was involved because only militaries can afford tanks. And that's a really nice shorthand that we've been using to figure out who's attacking us. In cyberspace, with emerging technologies, and actually ISIS is a good example, tactics are democratizing from nations and non-nation state actors to corporations and maybe individuals. Right? So today's top secret NSA programs become tomorrow's PhD theses and the next day's hacker tools. And this stuff all flows downhill. If you remember last November, when Sony was attacked, there was a debate in the United States, a legitimate debate among experts, whether the attack was perpetrated by North Korea, government with a $20 billion military budget, or two guys in a basement somewhere. And that's extraordinary that we can't tell the difference. And I think this speaks to ISIS as an organization that's a non-nation state actor, but is acting kind of nation statey in ways that we don't like, because we have rules about nation states and that tend to work. Or if you look at some of these emerging, but I think it's catastrophic risks, whether it's bio or nano, right? These technologies, which you think of as only the purview of a government or someone with a government-like budget, democratizing into the hands of everyone. And I think we're all trying to deal with how do we maintain security in this world of democratized threats.
Jessica, you want
to? I completely agree. I don't really have anything to add.
I think what's also interesting is that we had, I think mostly before 9/11, but even now when we talk about ISIS sort of as a separate category, the sense that there are the national security threats and there are the personal security threats, and that you can somehow draw a line of what's the business of the military and the defense establishment and what's the business of the police department. But part of what the democratization of threat does is that it blurs those lines. So we saw several near collision incidents of people, just hobbies, flying drones near airports and kind of near misses with passenger airliners, or some guy landing a drone during the US Open into a stadium. Those were not even malicious intent operations, but it just tells you what is possible out there. So it's not just the nation state versus the individual, it's sort of what are the motivations, why do people do these things, and sort of blurring the lines of how we think about regulating national security and regulating everyday technology that we use and rely on.
And some of this is good, right? We like it when individuals have power. Let's think of Syria, think of Iran, think of China. We want this democratization of power. We want the state to have less power and the dissidents, the free thinkers, the individuals to have more power. So there's good and bad here. And
so what I would say is I see, very much related to Juliet's work, that believe it or not, moms are absolutely critical to stopping the flow of foreign fighters. They are in many ways more important than law enforcement. I've been doing work in the Somali refugee community, and the kids who are attracted, it used to be Al-Shabaab, now they're attracted to ISIS, their moms can't figure out what they're doing because they don't actually speak English, and they certainly don't speak internet, which is a big problem. They need to go get trained over at the Berkman Center.
Well, one of these, thanks for the plug, I'll end on that. But one thing that, Jessica, where you differ, or where ISIS, that threat differs, is, and I'll be the, the cynic here. So what you all describe is threats, what Gabby and Bruce describe are threats, and they're scary, but, you know, okay, whatever, they might be bad, and a few things happen here or there, but land is what matters to the enemy. And it's where Jessica's work with ISIS really does differ in some sense. This would be the traditional notion of foreign affairs and national security. That ISIS has been able to use new capabilities and new technology, but that's only consistent with and complementary to the massive amount of land that they now govern in parts of the world. So first of all, describe how those two pieces of ISIS work to make it as successful as it is, and then challenge me on that notion that land, you know, that I'm in the 20th century world.
Well, land is both ISIS's strength and a vulnerability, because it means that it's possible to attack them in a way that wouldn't be possible if they didn't have a location. The reason land is so important to this group, it's a proto-state, it's an organized criminal ring, extraordinarily successful at criminal activities. In fact, it was founded by a secular thug who found religion. It's important to them because their most important source of revenue is what they call taxation and what we would call just theft.
Protection.
Yeah. So that is one of the things that makes this group different. It's both its strength and its vulnerability.
So I think land is very important if for a group like ISIS that declares a state or a caliphate and there's a sense of domination and control over a territory that gives you a special seat at the table of the international community, if you want. But for most types of threats that, you know, we talk about, you don't need territory. It actually doesn't matter where you are physically. To attack somebody on cyber, you can be anywhere around the world. It really doesn't matter. To start a bio threat, a bio weapon, or release some harmful virus, it doesn't matter where you are physically. And the drones, as we know, allow you remote attacks where it doesn't really matter where you are physically. So I think, if anything, that these new emerging technologies diminish the importance of territory. On the flip side, I think Jessica is absolutely right, that territory is now also a vulnerability. By the way, not just for ISIS. So the United States can control what happens in its own territory, but has no jurisdiction elsewhere. So if you have a cyber attack emanating from somewhere else, the FBI or anyone doesn't have jurisdiction there. They can't do anything about it. Plus, even within the United States territory, the government now relies on all these private companies that Bruce is talking about. So think about the BP oil spill. Who deals with the BP oil spill? Is it the government? No, it's BP. BP is the only body that has the expertise, the resources, the capacity to plug the well and clean the water. The government provides some, you know, support, perimeter support. But the government has become a much weaker actor, not in absolute terms, but in terms of its reliance, its essential reliance on private actors to perform its own executive functions.
And certainly we see the same things in cyberspace. When a company is attacked, it's the company that does the cleanup. Even Sony, who's attacked by North Korea, is not being defended by the U.S. government. I like this notion of land being both an asset and a liability. And it is. And depending on who you are, you're going to choose to be landed or not, depending on how that balance goes. Right? If you're ISIS, you're trying to become a state. You're trying to get into the, I guess, the UN, right? You're trying to be in the government club, so land is an asset. If you are a criminal group, if you are a hacker, land is a liability because now we know where you are. And when you see this democratization of tactics, you're seeing, as Gabby's talking about, a lot of tactics that don't need land. And this is, I think this changes with history. You know, this land as where power is centered is really only, you know, 1400s till now. Before then, the castle, the keep was important. The land around it was largely irrelevant. You could besiege for years and the land didn't matter. And it was those isolated pockets of where you were. Now I think nation states are fading more. And the notion of land as the locus of power, while still real important, I mean, the United States is an example, is getting fuzzier. It's getting more diffuse. I mean, think about, Rothkopf makes this point, and sort of imagine a big climate change negotiation, worldwide climate change negotiation. Who do you think has more power, Exxon or Bolivia? Right? It's not even close. The land doesn't give power in this particular sphere. And we're seeing more security-related spheres that have that characteristic.
A common theme, and I don't know if you know it, but all three of you mentioned the challenge between security and privacy in dealing with either U.S. populations and them being online or access to data. And all three of you sort of suggest, well, we shouldn't view it that way, that it's not a versus, it's an and, right? Security. And it seems to me, though, you know, in reading that, it's like I can't help the audience figure out how can you conceive of it as an and when the government, you know, can do this in terms of data analysis or drop drones anywhere in the world or, you know, monitor Muslim populations in the United States to make sure that violent extremism isn't going on. How can people think that in the future, given the kind of threats you're facing, that privacy will be a factor in any of this stuff?
So it's not just privacy. We say in the book we tend to think about security and liberty more generally as a balancing act. You give a little bit of something in exchange for the other, and there's sort of kind of a zero-sum game in between the two. And we think it's more accurate to think about it in terms of hostile symbiosis, if you want to take a term from biology, where these values sometimes conflict, but sometimes are actually mutually reinforcement. They always depend on one another. So security without liberty is largely meaningless, but it's also true that you can't have liberty without security. So we tend to have these debates about surveillance, for instance. This is where I think Bruce and we a little bit disagree on sort of the government surveillance as an evil, where, you know, it's privacy versus security. But now think about airport security. We don't call it surveillance because we don't like the word, but of course it's surveillance. And the reason we submit ourselves and go through the TSA airport security procedure is because we think it enhances both our security and our liberty to fly. We wouldn't be flying otherwise. Or when we have government regulation that protects our medical records, we don't trade liberty for privacy. We tend to think that this kind of regulation enhances both. The protection of our medical records enhances both our security and our privacy. So in this complex world where there are so many actors, there's the big brother, but there are so many little and medium-sized brothers out there, it would be wrong to just think about it as you always trade one for the other. A lot of the time, you're trying to maximize both.
So I also use the term liberty. I think I don't use security versus privacy. I really use liberty versus control. And the security versus privacy dichotomy comes from the belief that I think false, that surveillance enhances security. I mean, you said it. Yeah. We surveil Muslim populations because it counters terrorism. It actually doesn't. I mean, what we know about it is it is very invasive on the populations. They feel less secure. They feel less safe. They feel more hostile towards the surveillers. It's actually a documentary on a community south of Chicago, a Muslim community who has been surveilled through the 90s and early 2000s. Really, really beautiful commentary on what it does to the fabric of community. It doesn't make them more secure. So I think the security versus privacy dichotomy comes from this false belief that if you have less privacy, you get more security. But you know, we don't pine for Chinese-level surveillance. We don't pine for East Germany. We don't wish we lived in Iraq. We actually like the fact that we have privacy, and that gives us security. Right? We're not secure when we are observed. And there's a really interesting primatology relationship where we feel like prey because surveillers feel like predators. Now, of course, there exist examples of sometimes when you have to give up something, some liberty, to get security. Airport security is a great example of that. Lots of others. We want the FBI to be able to investigate crimes and peer into our lives. So how do we make that trade-off? We do that, we have some mechanisms. And it's pretty simple: transparency, oversight, and accountability. When those mechanisms are in place, we feel secure giving the police abilities to invade our privacy because we know and we can verify that they're not going to do that capriciously or in self-serving ways. I mean, think about how this might work in a country like China, where you don't have those checks, which is why I look at something like NSA surveillance, which doesn't have transparency, you know, not counting Snowden, doesn't have oversight, doesn't have accountability. I mean, this is surveillance that is making us less secure rather than more secure, as opposed to something that the police might do, which will be much more transparent. It's kind of a long-winded answer.
So I guess I'd like to give a counterexample. The president announced in February of this year that there would be three pilot cities where there would be a countering violent extremism program. And one of them is Boston, another is Los Angeles, and another is Minneapolis. And there's a lot of concern about civil liberties when the government starts trying to work with individuals in a community that may be ripe for recruitment. By the way, there are many converts who are, as I said earlier, who are becoming foreign fighters for ISIS. But I think of how I would feel if I was worried about my child. What's happening, again, the moms want help. They are desperate for help from the government. They know they can't do it without the government, and yet the government can't do it without the moms. So there's an example where, on the one hand, there is a civil liberties concern, but the people who are most actually affected often aren't as concerned as those who are thinking about it intellectually.
Jessica brings a good point up in her book, which I wanted to for you to draw out a little bit, that the challenge for governments, because we'll talk about government response, the challenge for governments, especially in terms of ISIS, at least right now, is that there's a legitimate intelligence interest, this is her line, in allowing extremists to use social media up to a point. Right, that there's a dance in some ways going on with is something bad happening? And you don't have to think about ISIS, think about child pornography or any sort of more traditional law enforcement aspect. Can you describe that a little bit? I mean, is the government able to actually, you know, sort of monitor, but then be able to tell, okay, wait, we're past the point of this being a dance, and now this person is radicalized and about to jump on a plane?
So this group is unprecedentedly good at using social media, and they have been using especially Twitter. YouTube and Facebook took down ISIS recruitment sites much more quickly than Twitter did, but it is a very important source of information, the way they communicate, recruit, move on to encrypted sites, sometimes spending up to 100 hours trying to recruit one individual. The trade-off is, if you take it all down, as the United Kingdom is trying to do, how do you continue to be aware of what's going on? When you take down one Twitter account, another one pops up. And what my colleague, J.M. Berger, my co-author, found is that what happens is the new Twitter account, there are a lot fewer people like us. You know, obviously there are a lot of academics who are following these ISIS accounts. How do you find that trade-off? And you're right, Juliet, that presumably that applies in child pornography as well. There is a trade-off. And I think, unlike the United Kingdom, we haven't banned, we haven't insisted that every single one of those accounts get taken down immediately.
I mean, this is again the democratization of tactics. And so we're seeing ISIS use Twitter as an organizational tool. So can Pez collectors, right? So can Syrian dissidents. Yeah. So these tools of coordination, of communication, of organization are incredibly empowering for everybody, both the good guys and the bad guys, right? I mean, the only thing that's keeping our society afloat right now is there are way more good guys than bad guys. So most of the organization done on these sites with these systems, whatever they are, with modern technology, is for good. And I think it's really interesting to watch this balance. So Syrian dissidents use Facebook to organize. The Syrian government uses Facebook to arrest dissidents. So we're seeing this very complicated power play between traditional power, which I think of as governments and corporations, and this more distributed power, which, you know, might be ISIS, might be a criminal organization that wants to assassinate people with drones, that could be any, or individual drone hobbyists. So, and this balance is changing. And we're seeing this democratization, which really gets into Gabby's notion of many against many, and that's how I set you up for that.
Thank you.
So it's a little bit related to our previous conversation about the privacy and liberty and security. There's this notion that the internet is this virtual place that needs to be sacred because it's virtual. Okay, so it's where our thoughts are and our sort of other self, and that's why nobody should be in the business of watching what we do there. But there's a sense in which it's not virtual at all. It's where we have our very real loves and relationships and financial transactions and medical records and all of that. And just like you wouldn't want to be in a place that isn't policed in the physical world, I'm not sure I want to be in a place that isn't policed in the so-called virtual world. And I think the examples of Facebook and Twitter are wonderful because they raise something that Bruce talks a lot about in his book, and sort of what do we, as citizens, what claims do we have vis-a-vis those corporations that really give these platforms to all the wonderful things they create, but also the potential harms? Do we have any claim against them? And here I think we share very much the same sensibilities that, you know, think about product liability. We have demands from companies all the time to make sure that what they give us or produce for us is safe, regardless of whether it's security related or not. So think about Drug and Food Administration, right? The government can't make sure that the food you consume or the medicine you take is safe. What they can do is order these companies to make sure that it's safe. And I think a lot of that would have to feature in the conversation, not just what we want in our relationship with the big brother, but what we want from these corporations. How much self-regulation, mm-hmm. how much self-monitoring? Do they take down the sites or allow them? Is there something in our sort of citizenry demand from them that doesn't just leave it to market forces, but says, here's the line that you can't cross anymore?
So let me give you an example of this. Last week, John Brennan, director of the CIA, his AOL email account was hacked by a teenager, by a kid.
Why does he use AOL?
I know. Okay, why does he use AOL? Okay.
To be honest, that's the real story.
Because he's of the generation that got an AOL account and he was never hip enough to change. We know why he uses AOL. But what's important is that he did nothing wrong. He didn't have a lousy password. He didn't write it down. He didn't share. He didn't email it. What the hacker did is call Verizon, pretending to be a Verizon employee, and got information about John Brennan, credit card information, username, email address, a bunch of information, then used that, called AOL customer service, pretending to be John Brennan, and got the email password reset. Right, John Brennan sitting having dinner with his friends, and two companies, unbeknownst to them, are tricked into the hacker getting into his email. Who's at fault there? This speaks to Gabby's point directly, right? It is those companies' fault. And Brennan can't really do anything about it. It has to be the government that says to those companies, you can't be this sloppy. We're just not gonna let you, right? This is a matter of public safety. So we do agree that government needs to be able to take a much stronger hand in these commercial systems.
So the government, and in particular, specifically the US government, sort of comes off in these books as both bumbling and big and not hip enough and using AOL accounts, right? Compared to the 20-somethings who are, you know,
who are beyond email, right?
Yeah, who are beyond email. I know. When my daughter tells me, she's
only
like,
text.
Don't email me.
I'm
like,
text.
How else? Yeah, they don't do email anymore. I still print, I have to be honest with you. And also, though, a perception or narrative about the government as being omniscient, all-knowing, all-powerful, maybe both are true. But given the threats that you all describe, I think my overall question is, what can the government do? What should it do? And does it have the tools necessary given the kinds of threats that we describe? And Jessica, I'll start with you.
I think there's a limit to what the government can do, both about what's happening in Iraq and Syria. We're American. We think we have to fix every problem. Also, we played a role in creating that problem, so there's a sense of moral imperative. At the same time, I'm not sure how much we can do without making things worse. When it comes to recruitment of foreign fighters, it's very hard. The private citizenry can play a much bigger role. And I see an army of individual Muslims who have decided to take on this problem of recruitment, who are actually responding to kids online. In fact, yesterday I spent quite a bit of time, I don't usually do this, but there's a kid in Libya who's telling me that he's about to join ISIS, and we've been in communication for months. I mean, at least he says he's in Libya. I don't know where he is. Might be in Danvers. I don't know. And I've said that to him.
It'd be awkward for him. But.
I've said that to him. I don't know where he is. I don't.
but I, anyway, we've been having this long conversation. I also think the State Department is trying to respond to the online recruitment with something called Think Again, Turn Away, and it basically says, ISIS is really bad. Listen to us with love from the State Department. And it's a bunch of middle-aged people trying to come up with something.
With AOL accounts.
Exactly, and it really needs to be 19-year-olds who are doing that. And so I am going to be participating next fall in an effort to get students to compete to develop the best online platform to respond to this. I think that's important for the private sector to get involved.
Yeah, just to pick up on what Jessica is saying, that the challenge for the national security apparatus, for those of us who've spent a lot of time in government, meaning the revolution that has to take place, also has to do with security clearances. That the traditional notion of the white guy from Arkansas who speaks three languages getting recruited by the CIA, our next great government employee might have been arrested for pot use and a couple tattoos and
a hacker. We really hope he's a hacker.
Really good at hacking. And they will have to change the notion of it. Bruce?
I think it's going to be an overarching theme is the notion that governments are slow and ponderous, but very powerful. And the more distributed users are fast and nimble, but inherently less powerful. So we're going to see tussle's a bad word, right? This battle between the quick and the strong. Right, the cyber criminals and the FBI has to go through a procurement process, right? It has to get someone a clearance. You know, you don't have to get a clearance to join ISIS. It's probably best if you don't get one. So, right, so this group will move faster. This group will be stronger. So it's kind of a little David and Goliath thing here. And it really is an open question, who's going to win? I mean, traditionally, big and strong wins. You know, go back 10, 15, 20 years, fast one. But now governments are picking up. They're realizing that they have to act differently. So can they learn nimble? Can the fast learn strong? When new technologies emerge, you know, which side are they going to benefit? Right? Getting back to Syrian dissidents using Facebook to organize, Syrian government uses Facebook to arrest dissidents. Who's going to win? Who's going to win in the next platform? Twitter, right? You know, which is that going to favor? And all of these technologies, current and future, are going to affect this quick versus strong. And that's what you got to watch, whether it's strong corporate, strong government, whether it's quick criminal or quick dissident or quick anything.
I think there are several principles here. The first is that we shouldn't try or attempt to respond to every threat. Here I want to echo what Juliet has written about at great length, the concept of resilience. That if we want to be a free society, if we want to be true to the values we espouse, we need to live with a certain degree of threat. That's true in our everyday life, it's true in our global life, and it would be a grave mistake, and I think Jess makes the same point in her book, we shouldn't try and fix everything or try and respond to everything. It's not possible, and it has huge detrimental counter effects. So that's the first principle. Second principle is that the government can't do this alone. Bruce describes in his book the great reliance of the great NSA that is actually impotent without the private sector, right? The Verizons and the even AOLs of the world, right? The government must rely on them for partnerships in order to perform security functions. And the third is that we as citizens have a responsibility to engage in a conversation about preferences, tastes, and values. So let me give you two examples of the very different social attitudes we have towards regulating, or the government's role, if you want, in regulating technologies of mass empowerment. One is handguns. So we made a choice in the Constitution to
have a right to bear arms, and therefore any regulation can only be minimal and very restricted. Now think about a different technology of mass empowerment, the passenger car. Passenger cars are 2 tons of steel driving in high speeds on public roadways, operated by millions of people who are more or less experienced at doing so. It sounds crazy, absolutely crazy. The reason or the way we can enjoy driving at some risk, but not an intolerable risk, we think, is because we also have a very intricate system of licensing and identification and insurance and testing of both the vehicle and the driver. And we don't really have a social conversation about whether we have an inalienable right to drive without government interference. And I think the same kind of conversations we're going to have with regard to these emerging technologies that are sort of hip and novel and the young people's world. But we as citizens now have a responsibility to think what's a sensible way of control or addressing these issues that allow us to enjoy all the benefits of technology without putting us at an intolerable risk.
Thank you. Well, talking about making the discussion more democratic, we do want to open it up at this stage to any questions. I do not. I see a microphone now. There is a microphone right here if you could come up. And my only demand is that it is a question for the authors. And you can, we're going to be quiet on a Saturday. I'll give it a few seconds. Any questions for the panel? Yes, good. See if you wait long enough. Good. Well, you can. There can be more than one. We have a few minutes.
I guess my question is, about if we did nothing about ISIS, what would be the scenario?
I'm curious too, actually.
And I think you can all hear it, but the question was, if we did nothing about ISIS, just let it be, and what would happen?
Well, obviously, I don't have a crystal ball, but we do know that terrorist groups come and go, and they it's almost like fads. ISIS is fashionable today. It won't always be fashionable. At the same time, I think there are the Iraqi people are asking quite a bit of us, and they're asking for military assistance, and that's difficult. And there's a humanitarian crisis that I think we must respond to. In part because we did play a big role in the rise of this organization. It was formed in response to the invasion of Iraq. So, and then when we left Iraq in the way we did in the hands of a sectarian leader, that led to increased sectarian tensions, which ISIS has taken advantage of. ISIS will disappear. I do feel confident in saying that. The question is, what will be the humanitarian impact of it between now and when it ultimately disappears?
Hi, this question is primarily for Bruce, but for anybody who wants to say anything, and that is, in cybersecurity, you see so much more, the users are being asked to do so much more, change your passwords, make them longer and longer and longer, change them more frequently, et cetera, and people don't do this. And my question to you is, what are you seeing now that makes it easier for users to do the things that we need them to do, makes them have to do less work rather than more?
I think the John Brennan story shows that there's nothing. And I think whenever we... whenever we in cybersecurity, in the industry, make demands on users or blame the users, it's actually a failure of the system. That we as system designers have failed. Right? We need to have security mechanisms that work for the average users, like for my father. Right? Has to be able to use security. And you know, I know my father, and he's not gonna take a class. And so things have to work. So what I'm seeing that's good are things that work that are not seen. So right now, after decades of trying to get people to use email encryption, PGP, most of our email is now encrypted because, not because you're doing anything, but because we now have a dozen email providers instead of 10,000, and Yahoo and Google encrypt the mail between them. And Yahoo and Google and Microsoft and Apple. So there are all these peering arrangements. So behind the scenes, you don't even see it. Your email is encrypted. which means, you know, criminals can't get at it. And that's fantastic. When you pick up your cell phone, that radio call is encrypted from your phone to the tower. You don't know that's happening, but it means someone with a radio is not listening in your phone call. That's awesome. So what I see as the improvements in privacy and security and encryption are the things that happen behind the scenes. Because I have to deal with a user that has no skill.
And again, partly it's market forces that solve this. So it's enough that there's more than one email provider, so then they'll compete over better privacy tools, and that's going to take care of it. But a lot of the time, it's not going to be enough because there's also kind of a monopoly or a cartel, if you want, mm-hmm. around this. So a lot of these companies absolve themselves by providing you very, very elaborate licensing agreements that you have to click accept. When was the last time you actually read through the 500 pages? Right, neither did I, ever. And it's a way of transferring the responsibility, as Bruce says, from them to you, but that's just wrong.
I should say, in Bruce's book, the end of Bruce's book is recommendations for government, the private sector, and then the rest of us. So there are some things in it, but it's helpful for people who feel overwhelmed by this notion of the, you know, the cyber threat or data mining and things like that.
Just what are the best strategies for protecting ourselves against this? Read your book.
Reading all of our books is the single most effective thing you can do to keep safe.
This is why you should never trust the market.
Actually, if you buy the book and give it to your friends, you get an extra measure of protection that you wouldn't get otherwise.
A special discount for people with AOL email accounts.
So I'm actually going to follow on that question, right? Like you just said, none of us read the EULAs. We're all using these mobile devices with apps that require ridiculous kinds of access to our phones, and we go accept, 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 mm-hmm. right? So my question to you is, when you talk to people, so those of us who are not writers here, when you talk to your friends, they look at you like you're this crazy conspiracy theorist. And I'm just curious, what do you talk to your friends about? Like, how do you communicate without arm waving and sounding like, oh my God, here she goes again?
I changed the topic. I don't know about you. So this is hard. And I think one of the reasons is a lot of what we can do is around the edges. Right? Your data, 5 years ago, your data was on your computer, and I would tell you how to secure your computer. Now your data is on Google, it's on Facebook, it's on iPhoto, it's in the cloud, controlled by other companies. And you can't do anything. Your level of control is much less. Remember last year, iPhoto celebrities, right? Celebrities did nothing wrong. They posted their photos on iPhoto, believing they had some security and privacy, and found that Apple messed up. I mean, they could read the 87-page license agreement, but all it's going to say is, you got to trust us, and if we are lying to you, well, sorry, it was just business. So there are things we can do around, and in my book I talk about them, but this is largely around the edges, because it's so much out of our control. This is why I really believe we need government solutions, we need regulations, because this is feeling a lot like food safety. Yes, you should use a refrigerator, but if, you know, the peanut butter comes and it's got salmonella in it when you buy it, there's nothing you can do.
It also has to do with expectations. So given that we live in this semi-virtual but very real virtual world, and we get a lot of benefits from that, as Bruce and others have suggested, you have, and this goes back to the point about resilience, you have to accept and expect some degree of infringement of that. Just expect it. So I know this is where Bruce and I have different sensibilities. I just assume that the NSA reads all my emails and I don't particularly care.
I hope you entertain them.
I'm very entertaining.
It's much more
my colleagues reading my emails that I dread. Yeah. Than
she's the
NSA.
One going to ISIS websites. Yes. Yes. I mean, why is that?
I should say, you know, we are at a book festival, and Jessica, I want you to just pipe in for a second about, because all three of you have managed to write mainstream books about either very scary or very technical things to audiences that you know, aren't necessarily in the field 24/7, but you in particular actually sort of engage the enemy. Can you just spend a minute about sort of, I think people will be curious, like, how do you actually do that, like physically? Like, I mean, anyway, tell us.
Well,
because I don't know.
I used to go and hang out in Pakistan with jihadis, and I can't do that anymore. But the jihadis are, well, honestly, I'm afraid of Pakistan's intelligence agencies more than anything else, because they don't agree. But now it's quite easy to engage with jihadis or other kinds of terrorists online. So the world has changed, including in research of this topic.
Do you pretend to be an Islamist jihadi? Are you yourself? Are you engaging in subterfuge at all? Or
I never have engaged in subterfuge.
Hi, I'm an academic. Tell me about
Don't
being a
answer
jihadi.
This without a lawyer.
I'm really curious. Yeah, so it's just like you are. Yeah.
As I said yesterday, somebody had read my book, actually, Terror in the Name of My, a couple of books ago, and felt he started quoting the book, this guy who saying why he would like to join ISIS. So that's how he first came to me. He was quoting my book and saying he wanted to join ISIS.
And that wasn't the intended intent of your book.
No. And so I told him, please write me an essay about why you want to join and why you're not going to join.
Obviously,
you know,
professor.
I'm an academic, so that was my solution. Write me an essay. But the thing is, he keeps engaging with me. The guy who brought Al-Qaeda to America has gotten out of prison, and he really wants to get involved in communicating with jihadis online. He wants to be part of the solution. He learned in prison, and that's very easy to do. But the answer is, I never pretend to be someone I'm not. I thought that I wouldn't be very good at it in person, and we can't do that because of human subjects requirements. We can't do that.
Jessica's talking about rules at universities that prohibit basically falsity going on based on mostly scientific experiments, but obviously others. We have time for two more questions, if we can be quick with the questions and answers or direct them. Thank you.
All of y'all have mentioned so far government regulation is more of a necessity. But given the state of the United States Congress, do you all foresee that happening anytime soon, like within my lifetime?
You know, you're young, so yes within your lifetime, but no time soon. Yes, you're right. Government's pretty darn dysfunctional here.
You should. Something I'm involved with on the Homeland Security side, but you know, it looks like there will be some cyber legislation passed, just given what happened yesterday. So, despite everything you hear on TV, you know, take a look at where there's sort of a common, you know, there might be a common ground with various pieces of both parties maybe falling on the sidelines. So there might be some legislation passed. It's not controversial.
My guess is you're going to see the regulatory agencies step in. Recently, FAA said they're going to regulate all drone use. Right? I mean, so there's an example of something that can be done without Congress.
So part of it is devolution of power to the states. Now you see a lot of effort actually at the state level. I've been talking to the Massachusetts Attorney General about their efforts to see what they can do in the state without federal involvement. And also, just like in any other context, if and when we see a terrible thing happening, then there will be a government response. And this is the unfortunate way things work. There, you'll always respond to the most recent emergency. We're very good at ratcheting up. We're not that good at ratcheting back down, which is, again, unfortunate and part of the sort of you guys work on terrorism, the response to terrorism. But it has a lot to do with sort of responding to whatever is out there. As long as we're dealing with identity card thefts and things like that, you know, not too bad. If and when a catastrophic event happens, the response would be different.
Okay, the last question.
Hi, could you speak, you spoke earlier about licensing for cars. Mm-hmm. How would you feel that security would be enhanced or the opposite of that if we had to license internet users or had some kind of identifier for internet users?
So I wouldn't license internet users. I think that, that doesn't work. It's got all sorts of problems which are way beyond the scope of what we have left. I would really put onuses on providers. I mean, why does an ISP pass through all traffic and require my father to have a personal firewall? That seems nutty. I mean, so I don't see the users as really a place to regulate in the same way you might do cars. I'm more interested in maybe the analogy of the car manufacturers or the car dealers or the gas companies that are providing services to the users. To me, that's a much better point. You have smarter people you're regulating. You have more ability to make changes. So I would put more regulation there than regulating users. But we can certainly talk about internet driver's license. There has been people writing about it, and you could argue it either way. I tend to be against it.
And you can think about the other technologies as well. So I mentioned earlier the incident where a guy flew a drone into the U.S. Open Stadium. He actually came in to retrieve his drone, okay? Had he not done that, there was no way to trace the drone back to a particular operator. Now, if people are going to use these things in these ways, I want to be able to trace the drone back to an operator. And the same is true with companies that sell gene sequencing online and lab equipment. I want some kind of obligation to monitor who purchases what through these websites.
Okay, so I'm going to have to end it here. First of all, I've been asked to remind you that there's survey cards in your big pamphlets, if you could fill them out, because each year the Boston Book Festival gets bigger. Definitely that's true, and better. So we would love your feedback. And then just before the round of applause for our great panel, I do want to say again that given the world we live in, you know, it's easy to tune out. And these are three authors who have taken the time to provide narratives about threats in new threats in a scary world, so to speak, in ways that are very accessible. So please buy them and support their effort. So Jessica's book, ISIS, The State of Terror, nice and black, The Future of Violence by Gabby Bloom. And the subtitles, Robots and Germs, Hackers and Drones. And then, now you got me, Data.
Data.
I said it right the first time. Data and Goliath by Bruce Schneier. And they're all going to be back in the room in just a few minutes to sell their books. So thank you all for coming
out
on a Saturday morning.
Thanks.
And thank them.